Hey there, I'm Adam Rissman, and welcome to another episode of Inside Intercom. This week we're welcoming back not one, but two of our favorite past guests. That's engineering leaders Gene Su and Edmund Lau. When we last spoke with Edmund, he was an engineering leader over at Quip and had just released his book, The Effective Engineer. Gene, meanwhile, when we had her on, had just stepped away from her longtime role as an engineering manager at Medium. In the time since, they both come together with a common goal: transforming engineers into leaders. And they're doing this through a company they've started together, Co-Leadership. Co-Leadership is taking the most valuable lessons that Gene and Edmund have learned through coaching over the years and distilling them down into workshops and online courses. So this week, with Intercom's Senior Director of Engineering, Lewis Bennett, steering the conversation, we're going to take a deep dive into some of those lessons and frameworks that Edmund and Gene have put together and hear a little bit about what they've learned themselves in the first 6 months of co-leadership. Their chat covers the difference between leadership and management, which are two things that are far from mutually exclusive, how to create a culture of healthy two-way feedback between your tech leads and ICEs, and why trust is the foundation of the most effective engineering teams. If you want more insights from Edmund and Gene, they've actually put together a special guide for Inside Intercom listeners. It's all about how to design better working relationships. And to get your free copy, simply visit co-leadership.com/intercom. And to get more insights from our team, be it on engineering, product, design, marketing, or the business of startups, check out our library of more than 120 Inside Intercom episodes. You can find us on iTunes, Spotify, Overcast, and all the rest. Now, I'm going to hand the mic over to Intercom's Lewis Bennett, who's in the studio with Edmund Lau and Gene Su.
You're listening to Inside Intercom. Intercom, making internet business personal at scale. Learn more at intercom.com.
Gene and Edmund, welcome to Inside Intercom. To get started, can you give us a feel for what led you both to co-leadership and explain your mission there?
Sure. So we both spent about a decade each in various engineering roles, including, you know, IC, tech lead, and other engineering leadership roles. And I think both of us had this experience where we felt stuck, like we wanted to have more influence and impact than we were having, but we were trying all these things and we couldn't figure out how to do it. And then once we connected and started, we both moved into coaching engineering leaders, and we saw that this was a pretty common like pattern that people were going through. Mm-hmm. And so we really wanted to help people bridge that gap and make it an easier transition and also, you know, help people live the lives and have the careers they really dream of.
Yeah, I feel like there were times earlier in my career where, you know, I sort of wanted more leadership roles. And I would do things like, can I ask my manager to become a manager? I would just sort of be like waiting for sort of leadership and authority to be handed to me. And like when that didn't happen, it just felt like, okay, what do I do now? And I think Jean's had like a very similar experience in her career. And it's sort of very easy in a lot of the people that we talk to, a lot of the people that we coach, for them to sort of then feel stuck and like be waiting for opportunities to come. And a lot of our work in co-leadership is helping people bridge that gap, like to feel empowered to actually start leading from where they are.
And how do you guys define leadership?
Leadership is, it's like having some sense of like the impact and the influence that you want, and then feeling empowered to take steps toward moving toward that direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think leadership is really about your mindset, mm-hmm. rather than like, I think a lot of times people will wait for a leadership role to be granted to them or their potential to be recognized and then given this title. Mm-hmm. But what we've seen is like a lot of people want that, and then what they hear is, oh, you need to display leadership before you can have the role. And then they just like don't really know what that means. Like I didn't know what that meant. And I tried a bunch of things and, you know, not with much success. And so I think leadership is really, as Edmund mentioned, more about the mindset of taking initiative, of being responsible for the changes you want to see.
And an implication of that is that then, you know, everyone really can be a leader. It's not something that has to be attached to a title or a role. Mm-hmm. It's something that you can decide and choose to take on. And I think we believe that given the right tools, you can be more effective at doing that. Yeah.
And especially with engineering teams, if you think of leadership just as management, there aren't that many like spots, right?
Exactly.
Right. Or yeah. Like, and so you see a lot of people moving into roles just like mid or senior level ICs or tech lead or tech lead manager. And all these roles, you know, they change very quickly and they're not super well defined. And so we really want to equip people with the skills to have leadership in these types of roles that may not be explicitly, you know, hey, your role is an engineering manager.
Yeah, I think that's super cool from a like power within the role. Mm-hmm. A lot of the discipline of engineering management, there's a certain kind of inherent tension to it because someone will have developed their skill set in one, I don't know, one walk of life, computer science might be, or another technical discipline. And then there's so much kind of organizational gravity pulling people towards management role, which is a totally different discipline.
Right.
But the leadership is kind of the something you can do to be a senior individual contributor across all those things, or like the kind of proverbial quote unquote working manager role, that it's awesome. It kind of fits into both that gaps as well as can provide a strong foundation to switch from one to the other.
Right.
Yeah, I think like management or even like being a tech lead, they're very obvious models of how to grow leadership. And it's often the ones that we gravitate to by default. Mm-hmm. But if you start to think about like organization companies, there are a lot of different problems that exist in an organization where there are gaps that exist. And really sort of anyone who builds awareness around that gap and like takes initiative toward it can step up and be a leader, even without any of those sort of following those like default patterns of, you know, what it means to be a manager or what it means to be a tech lead.
Mm-hmm. So shifting topics a little bit, I know one of the things that you've done as part of co-leadership is have both trainings for people across a lot of different companies, as well as deeper trainings with specific companies as well. I'm sure that the attendee experience has been entirely awesome. But what I'm curious for you is what each of you have learned in that process as well. Like, what do you think the most impactful things or the most surprising things have been from your training, learning from the attendees of your courses?
One thing that comes to mind is for our independent events, we have people come in pairs. Mm-hmm. That's what we've done for the last few events. So we'll have some people like an engineering manager and a product manager who've been working together for a year or a year and a half. And, you know, we teach them some skills around like, how do you discover what's important to the other person? And then we send them off to have like a 5-minute conversation using these skills of asking, you know, open-ended questions and really listening. And they'll come back and say something like, oh, I just discovered more about like what motivates this person. I didn't even know that. And I've been working together for like a year and a half. Right. And that's like so rewarding for us to hear that we're actually having that impact on people who work together all the time.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like super motivating because it also makes us think, you know, if we can really sort of spread the work that we're doing at scale and sort of teach a lot of these, you know, foundational trust building, relationship building skills to more people, it feels like so many more teams would be able to like achieve higher levels of success. If you're like able to really understand what's important to all the stakeholders around you, all the people you work with, and you're able to like design much more fulfilling relationships at work, I think people would get so much more done.
Yeah. And be way more efficient too, right? It's a 5-minute conversation and probably, you know, that relationship is now much more productive and efficient because of it.
Yeah. It's amazing how much of getting work done is just getting people to actually trust each other, to work well together, to find areas where motivations are aligned or not aligned in order to help get stuff done versus just doubling down on like, hey, we need to do this thing. Why aren't we doing this thing?
It's
like, okay, how do we actually work together to have shared accomplishments and things like that?
I think that's one of the reasons why this is kind of a gap is as engineers, we're so focused on the how, the problem solving, like how do you solve this problem? So it's easy to focus on the tactical elements of something rather than taking a step back and investing in, you know, trust building and discovering what's important to people.
Yeah, I've always kind of approached this from the simple fact that I can't read people's minds. And if something is important to someone, they'll need to tell me that as well. And I can infer, but the likelihood that I'll get that wrong is also very high. So if it's like, hey, I think you'd be great at this, someone will need to tell me, that sounds horrible. I don't want to do that. Like, because none of us will be right all the time in that way. And so finding ways for people, whether it's, like you said, an EM and PM working together, or whether it's peers or a manager and their direct reports, finding ways to actually be able to effectively communicate, it's so empowering. It's one of the things I really love about the strategy with what you guys are doing.
Yeah, I think when we realize that we can't read people's mind, it means both that like we have to share what's important to us, but we also have to ask people what's important to them. So it sort of becomes like this two-way, essentially discovery conversation where you sort of put what's important out on the table so you can actually start to make decisions around it.
When you think about teams where it's more than just a one-on-one conversation, but it's kind of what's important to either individual members on the team or what's important to a team collectively, have you found any kind of frameworks that work well for teams to talk about things like this?
Yeah, I mean, actually, it just sort of reminds me of like the Medium workshop that we ran a while back where like, with the members of the engineering team from Medium, And it was actually sort of the inspiration for why we started doing pairs at our workshops. Mm-hmm. There's just like all this like shared context from people who are working in the same team. But oftentimes, like what's important to this group of people isn't made explicit. In this workshop we did, one of the prompts that we asked people was, what are gaps that you notice in the organization or on the team? And just sort of creating this like shared pool, this shared context of, you know, what gaps everyone saw and like sort of what they wanted their team to be. People were able to share a lot of things and just build a lot of confidence that, oh, the gap that I see in the team isn't just something that I see. It's something that everyone else sees too. I'm just sort of the one putting words to it in this group. But there's actually a lot of buy-in, a lot of alignment, a lot of support if I were to take initiative and like go and tackle that.
Right. I think without that level of alignment, it's easy to think that, but this is, I'm the only person that this is, you know, bothering. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, no one else is having this problem because no one's bringing it up. And so everyone's kind of sitting with this thing thinking, oh, like I shouldn't bring it up. I don't want to be, you know, the one complaining or, yeah.
Yeah. And that's like a broader limiting belief that we also see among a lot of engineering teams. It's just like people think that, oh, I am alone in having this problem.
Or someone else will fix it.
Yeah, that's or someone else will too. Fix it. And like when we sort of have those beliefs, it's like if I'm alone in having this problem, then I don't want to sort of disrupt everyone else by bringing it up. Mm-hmm. Or if I think that someone else is going to solve it, then I'm not going to take action. And so the impact of either of those beliefs is such that like I feel less empowered to take leadership. Mm-hmm. And those end up being just like two of the beliefs that we, you know, work towards equipping people with the tools to overcome in these like leadership experiences that we run or these like company programs that we run.
Yeah, it feels like there's also some crossover in some ways with ideas like blameless postmortems and things like that of people being able to have shared vulnerability in a way to say, okay, here is exactly what happened. Let's not talk about the who, but let's talk about the circumstances that created this and really encouraging people to name the obvious, whatever mm-hmm. someone perceives as obvious, to generate more insightful conversation that way. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly something we do here that is very effective at promoting the greater good and helping people understand like, oh, it's not necessarily a people problem. Maybe it has to do with the circumstances of the problem or something we haven't prioritized or some other extenuating circumstance, et cetera. Those frameworks work best when people can build upon like an existing strong relationships as well as a place to be safe, I guess, as well. When I think about your work, I think a lot about the research that's been done about people being able to perform better when they have psychological safety mm-hmm. and that vulnerability and psychological safety kind of go hand in hand mm-hmm. as well. Have you seen any kind of direct or indirect experience that would confirm or refute that?
Well, I think something that comes to mind is in one of the Medium workshops, we also had people like go around and hear the impact that they've had on other people or have everyone else in the group talk about the impact that that person has had on them. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about blameless postmortems, we usually think about it when like something's gone wrong. And so a lot of our work is focused on like, and this builds psychological safety, is mm-hmm. is focusing on what's going well,
yep.
right? And so hearing from like 10 people like, hey, when you do this, like it makes me feel inspired to do my work more. Or when we do our postmortems, it's mostly positive. It's like happiest moments, biggest wins.
Lessons learned, like assessment of progress, and then gratitudes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it really is focused on like what's going really well, and that really builds up psychological safety. So then when we do have to give each other feedback in the moment, like we have this trust that like, hey, we both just really enjoy working with each other and like are doing really meaningful work.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that certain personalities get that better than others? So if I speak for myself, I've gone through performance reviews before where you get like, oh, everything's going well, things like that. And I'm just like sitting on the edge of my chair waiting to hear about the things I could do better. Mm-hmm. There's a certain kind of, I'm not saying I don't listen, but it's that's not the feedback I'm craving in some ways. Like oftentimes I'm like, how can I get better? What can I do to improve? That people don't provide enough or get enough credence to positive reinforcement and feedback. Mm-hmm. That way,
I think it's a very strong like engineering bias. Like when we do code reviews, we look for what's wrong. Mm-hmm. Like it's oftentimes very rare for people to say like what's going right in a piece of code, and we end up sort of applying that same mentality to people. Even though like you know for a lot of like teams that are doing really well, probably you know if 80% of the time things are going well, maybe like 80% of the retrospective should be spent on sort of celebrating what's going right.
We're figuring out how to do more of what's going right,
right.
than yep. focusing on the small percentage of things that are not going well. Right.
Right. Because like one risk of like not focusing on what's going right is like if people don't know the impacts that they're having with all the positive actions they're doing, they might stop doing it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an important point, is when people share positive feedback, they often don't talk about the impact of the positive things you're doing, right? So they'll just say, hey, you did a good job. Or something that just kind of seems like vague or vague and positive, mm-hmm. but they don't say like, hey, because you did this, now like so-and-so can really be unblocked, or this person feels much better about their work, or, you know, they don't share the impact. And I think a lot of times when you don't have the impact shared, especially as engineers, we tend to just focus on like, what are the things I can change, right?
Mm-hmm. It's almost like saying, where are the bugs? And it makes the assumption that everything else is working.
Right.
Versus teasing out and be like, oh, okay, this whole system works because of all these amazing things. And there's some things we could tweak, but everything is going predominantly well.
Yeah,
I think of every postmortem I've done, and if it's like, okay, things that went well, things that could go better, and specific things to change, the things that can go well column is always given short shrift. It's like mm-hmm. three or four different things, and it's none of this kind of what's the root cause for why things are going well.
Right.
It's more digging into like, okay, why didn't that happen? What was the sequence and all that kind of thing? Mm-hmm. That there's like separate issues with kind of the militaristic aspect of it. It's like trying to dive into like root causes if it's battle or something like that. But from a healthy culture perspective, yeah, you want to make sure you don't end up like messing up the good stuff while you're trying to fix some of the things that could be going better.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's like so much research around, you know, the field of positive psychology around like how happiness leads to more success and better performance. And so I think like celebrating what's going right can also just create like a much happier team and also lead to better performance and success for the team too.
Mm-hmm. So one thing about organizational happiness, it's super important to us at Intercom. It's basically the lifeblood of teams. So we've got all varieties of different pulse surveys and other things like that to tell us about what's working well. We spend a lot of time ensuring that that's going to be the case too, that we continue to do that and better while addressing it. So using the same kind of postmortem framework, but with team survey data as well. Are there other effective mechanisms that you're aware of for teams to kind of diagnose how they're doing at scale?
I think for a company to just prioritize organizational happiness and like how seamlessly things are working is like, that's probably just the first step that I think a lot of teams don't even focus on, right? It's much more like, what's the short term? Like, are you shipping, right? And like, maybe not even looking at like, hey, is this manager's like direct reports? What's the retention? What's the, you know, what are the pulse surveys saying? Mm-hmm. So I think just having any metric related to organizational happiness is kind of better than where most teams are at.
Just before we continue with today's episode, I wanted to let you know that episode 2 of Offscript, our new series of candid conversations with Intercom, all about the extraordinary AI-driven transformation we're currently experiencing, is out now on YouTube. Here's a teaser featuring our Chief Product Officer, Paul Adams, discussing AI-first customer service.
The best place for me to start is that technology only moves in one direction. Once you go through these like before-after moments, you never go back. AI has clearly already shown us that it can help in transformational ways. It has given us a new way to do customer service. And that new way is AI first. The business that provides incredible customer service is the business that will win. And the earlier that people lean into this completely new mindset, the earlier they can deliver this incredible holy grail type of customer experience. It's a huge opportunity for businesses to literally change how people think about them. It's just a matter of time.
That's all to come on episode 2 of Offscript. You can watch it on Intercom's YouTube channel right now, and we'll bring you audio versions of the episodes right here. Now, back to today's episode.
I'm relatively new to Intercom. I started in February. And one thing that's different for me versus other companies I've worked for is the geographical distribution of the employee base. So mm-hmm. we're in 5 different offices in 4 different countries. Mm-hmm. And so being able to effectively work together across continents is predicated on trust. Mm-hmm. And being able to say, there's an aspect of happiness within that, but it's basically you, until you physically meet people in person, everyone is two-dimensional in that space. You don't necessarily get to get that character of like, oh, okay, this is who this person is. This is like how they feel about these things, and the kind of offhand conversations that help build trust over time. having explicit conversations in my introductions here around someone. So like, oh, okay, that's great. I can tell you all about what you need to know professionally, but actually, let me just tell you a little bit about myself. Mm-hmm. Those have made for such strong working relationships in the process of like, yeah, okay, like it's currently, you know, so if it's 11 o'clock in San Francisco, it's 7 o'clock at night in Dublin. That's going to be a hard conversation to have. I need to remember that if I have an urgent question for someone, that I'm taking him or her away from their families or away from the pub or something else as well. That even acknowledging that, or if they're calling me at 5 o'clock in the morning, acknowledging that I might be waking up, makes it easier to work together too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the remote or the geographical distribution makes it, it's like a forcing function to make sure that you have the explicit conversations that build trust, mm-hmm. right? Because a lot of times on Teams, you kind of rely or fall back on being able to see each other, kind of getting a sense of like, hey, is this person doing okay just by seeing them at their desk? And so I think in the absence of that, it actually forces you to have these conversations more explicitly.
Yeah. I feel like sometimes where sort of like remote teams run into issues is when the meetings are sort of focused on around like logistics or like sort of handle, like basically making sure the logistics work, as opposed to spending time, kind of like you said, like getting to know one another and just understanding what people's like core motivations are and sort of what's important to them and like sort of what makes them happy at their job. There's also a piece I think that would sort of accelerate building trust, which is just sharing, like whenever issues do arise, sort of clearing up the stories that get in the way. Like you talked about sort of vulnerability earlier, and one of the researchers who sort of really influenced like our leadership experience work is also like Brené Brown, who just like does a lot of research into vulnerability and how like oftentimes the stories we make up about people that we don't know too well hold us back from stronger working relationships. Mm-hmm. And I think sort of with remote working relationships, oftentimes, you know, when there is conflict, if there isn't just ways of like clearing them up of like these narratives that we make about other people, that's sort of when like trust becomes harder to build. But like spending time clearing up those stories helps build that trust a lot.
Yeah, you can definitely get pretty imaginative with stories when you don't see the person in the office, right?
Totally.
It's like, well, what did that person mean when they said this on Slack? Or, or what did that email really mean, or the code review comment?
Yeah, I think we're all our own worst enemies when it comes to interpreting what other people said, and either in the sense of giving people too much credit for what they're saying and missing something nefarious, it's very unlikely. Whereas the much more common case is like there's some offhand comment that we're then, you know, mentally chewing on for hours on end, being like, that was not the intention of what that
comment
was.
Yeah, meanwhile, they were just trying to get through like, you know, 20 pull requests and like they were tired or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like I was afraid there was going to be a syntax error. I'm sorry. Like basics. So I've worked over time with a lot of different engineers kind of going through the main transition into some variety of leadership role, or like a lot of the kind of fundamentals, idea of co-leadership from my understanding of it, correct me if I'm wrong, is the sense of like people are ready to like dip their toes into it. And there's a chicken egg scenario of like becoming a leader before you can become a leader. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've done is I'll recommend people some books that are interesting to me. Mm-hmm. What books have been interesting to you, or what reading has been interesting to you to help people understand like what engineering leadership means, what engineering management means, mm-hmm. or any other kind of learning?
One of my favorites is 5 Dysfunctions of a Team, and that also ties into, you know, what we've been talking about with trust, because the author talks about like this foundation, like these 5 dysfunctions that you really need to address in a sequence. So the basic one is lack of trust, mm-hmm. and building trust, and how that can be the foundation for everything else. And it's written as a fable, so it's really easy to read, and talks about sort of the dysfunctions of an executive team.
Another book that I really like that's less focused on like management is this book called Extreme Ownership by Jocko Willink, who used to be a former Navy SEAL and like ran the team in Iraq. And a lot of that book is around this mindset of, you know, what he calls extreme ownership, like taking ownership of the outcomes. And I just remember one story from the book where he talked about one training exercise where he sort of broke his squad into a bunch of different subgroups, and they were running these races, and they took like the leader from the winning group and swapped it with the leader from the losing group, and that losing group was able to win. And it was just like this person had embodied what it meant to take ownership over that group, and was able to like motivate everyone in that group to actually do well. I think like that book sticks with me because it just has this mindset of like you are in charge of the results that you want to see. And it is not someone else's responsibility. And oftentimes, we disempower ourselves when we believe it's someone else's responsibility.
It reminds me of another book that I found really influential, which is Turn the Ship Around. And it kind of talks about this, I don't know what the correct term is, but he runs a nuclear submarine, and he changed the entire model from like a leader-follower model where he would go around and like there was a hierarchy of, hey, do this, and then that person would tell someone else what to do, to a leader-leader model. And so by the end, he was just kind of like wandering around the submarine. People would come up to him and say like, hey, this is the context. I'm going to make this decision. What do you think? And then just like, okay, that sounds good. And he just like go around kind of approving things, and everyone would come to him with the information he needed to make the decision. And so, I mean, for me, it was sort of like, if this guy can do it with a nuclear submarine, like we can definitely do it with like, you know, running internet software.
it puts it in context. For sure. Yeah, I think there's something about the way, like we were talking earlier about how software engineering is one discipline and then management is another. But sometimes it feels like there's no idea sharing in the way that software engineers do management as well, where we think about like, how do you break things into component parts and have distributed systems that talk to each other? And then management tends to be this kind of top-down orchestrated thing that has fewer of those components that way as well. Mm-hmm. I always like hearing about books that have ostensibly nothing to do with software engineering because it brings in new ideas that way. Yeah, to the same effect if it's like, oh yeah, here's someone who's coordinating these two different pools of a race, and like it just takes that one person to coordinate those different things. It's like there's not an easy analogy for that within computer science, which makes you think more. You have to use different neurons in that case.
Yeah. I think that's also like an aspect that that makes us really excited about our work is like, how do we sort of translate some of these concepts from that are already like pretty well known in other industries into language that maybe like engineers can sort of better resonate with? Like, how do we sort of use our engineering careers and like everything we've learned about, you know, abstractions or investments in infrastructure? Like, how do we sort of use those same concepts but apply them to relationships?
Yeah, like I think every engineer has an idea of like, okay, when the technical debt gets bad, you need to chip away at it. You need to invest in it. You need to, you know, create projects around it. And the same is true for relational debt, right? Like if you invest in it upfront, then you can set yourself up for a better relationship down the road. But, you know, sometimes relational debt gets pretty bad, and then you have to, you know, really invest a lot of time to make a working relationship better.
Right. Or like, we'll know that like, we definitely should design our software if we wanted to achieve the goals that we want, but we don't sort of apply that same mindset to our relationships. Like, if we want our relationship to turn out a certain way, it would be helpful if we explicitly designed them.
Does there become a point where it becomes awkward, where you're talking so much about your relationship and how you measure successes of relationships among teammates, it makes it a little impersonal in your experience? Or is it something where it's both people just know what's going on and it's like, oh yeah, cool, that's just what we're gonna do?
Right now, like what we've seen is an underinvestment in talking about how people want to work together. And I think we're pretty far off from like over-investing in there. And at least for us working together, we definitely invest a lot of time in conversations just around like what's going out well, what's not going well. And it's always been surprising to me like how well it's paid off and made everything else easier.
Also, like any sense of awkwardness, I think, just comes from like using like a new muscle that you just haven't exercised before. So it's like maybe a little uncomfortable, like you don't quite know how to do it correctly. And a lot of our day-long events that we run are teaching people the language that they can use to sort of have these like discovery conversations or sort of like design their relationships better, like what language they can use to sort of ease into those conversations.
But also like to embrace that it's going to be different from what you're doing day to day. And so it is going to feel a little bit awkward. And so I think that's why a lot of times people read, communication books, and then they understand intellectually that this could work. And then they go to work and then they don't use any of the things that the book says to do, right? Mm-hmm. Because you don't get the kind of stepping stone of like practicing in a safe environment and then transferring it to work.
Yeah, so you compartmentalize versus synthesize in that way. Yeah. As you guys look forward, what's next for you at Co-Leadership? Are there any things you'd want the listeners of Inside Intercom to know about?
Yeah, and one thing that we've actually put together for the Intercom listeners is just a guide on how to design your relationships as alliances. It's something, a tool that we put together to sort of really get a sample of like some of the things that we teach in our leadership experiences as well as our leadership programs with companies. It's like, how do you ease into a conversation where you actually have an explicit discovery phase of like understanding what's important to the other person, and then how do you sort of build alignment around that? Mm-hmm. And then looking forward, we're starting to spend our time trying to take a lot of these like leadership experiences that we've been running in the Bay Area and broaden the reach to people all over the world. And so we're starting to launch our online courses and build sort of longer multi-week programs where people can learn some of the material around like investing relationships, around building trust, around building effective teams, and learn that in like across videos as well as like just experiential practice sessions that we do online.
Yeah, we're also interested in running in-person events, not just in the Bay Area, doing some travel as well.
Awesome. I will say the topic area you guys cover, I'm super passionate about. I'm super excited to see two people that are so competent attacking this for a lot of different companies and really helping them open their eyes to their potential. I want to thank you both for taking the time to talk with us. It's been great.
Thanks.
Fun.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Inside Intercom podcast. For more episodes, visit soundcloud.com/intercom. If you'd like to subscribe, search for Inside Intercom in iTunes or Stitcher. And for even more great content, check out blog.intercom.com.